They will change clothes and head to Bridget Desjardins' house for the biggest and best graduation party in the school. The next morning, they leave for a week-long camping trip to Casco Bay, just the two of them. Once they return home, it will be work at the drive-in for Gwendy and at the hardware store for Harry. In early August, a 10-day vacation at the coast with Harry's family. After that, it's on to college. Brown for Gwendy, nearby Providence for Harry, and an exciting new chapter in their lives. They can't wait. Gwendy knows she will have to make a decision about what to do with the button box once it's time to leave for college. But that's months in the future, and it's not a priority this evening. The biggest decision facing Gwendy at the moment is which dress to wear to Bridget's party. "Good Lord," Harry says, smiling. "Just pick one already, or go as you are." As she is, happens to be in bra and panties. Gwendy gives him a poke in the ribs and turns to the next page in the catalog. "Easy for you to say, mister. You'll put on jeans and a t-shirt and look like $1 million. You look like a trillion in your underwear." They're lying on their stomachs on Gwendy's bed. Harry is toying with her hair. Gwendy is paging through the glossy brown catalog. Mr. and Mrs. Peterson are at dinner with neighbors down the block, not expected back until late. Gwendy and Harry came in an hour ago, and Gwendy was mildly surprised to find she didn't need to use her key. The front door was not only unlocked, but slightly ajar. Her dad is big on locking up. Likes to say Castle Rock isn't the little country town it used to be. But everyone forgets stuff. Plus, Dad's not getting any younger. And with thoughts of the party to occupy them, not to mention 30 minutes of heaven in her bed beforehand, neither notices a few splinters sticking out around the lock or the pry marks. "Come on," Harry says now. "You're a knockout. It doesn't matter what you wear." "I just can't decide whether to go strapless and dressy or long and flowy and summery." She tosses the catalog on the floor and gets up. "Here, I'll let you choose." She walks to the closet, opens the door, and smells him before she sees him. Beer, cigarettes, and sweat funk. She starts to turn around and call to Harry, but she's too late. A pair of strong arms reach out from the shadows and hanging clothes and pull her to the floor. Now she finds her voice. "Harry!" He's already off the bed and moving. He hurls himself at Gwendy's attacker, and amidst a tangle of clothes hangers and blouses, they grapple across the floor. Gwendy pushes herself back up against the wall and is stunned to see Frankie Stone, dressed in camo pants, dark glasses, and t-shirt, as if he thinks he's a soldier on a secret mission, rolling around her bedroom floor with her boyfriend. That's bad, but something else is worse. Lying on the closet floor, half buried in fallen clothes, is a scatter of silver dollars and the button box. Frankie must have found it while he was waiting for her, or while he was waiting for Harry to leave. Has he pushed any of the buttons? Is Africa gone? Or Europe? The two men crash into the night table. Hairbrushes and makeup rain down on them. Frankie's secret agent man shades fly off. Harry outweighs Frankie by at least 30 pounds and pins the skinny little dipshit to the floor. "Gwen," he sounds perfectly calm, "call the police. I've got this skanky little motherf-" But that's when it all goes to hell. Frankie is skinny. Frankie doesn't have much in the way of muscles. But that is also true of snakes. He moves like a snake now, first wriggling, then hoisting one knee into the crotch of Harry's boxers. Harry makes an oof sound and tilts forward. Frankie pulls one hand free, makes finger prongs, and jabs them into Harry's eyes. Harry screams, claps a hand to his face, and falls to one side. Gwendy pushes herself up in time to see Frankie coming at her, grabbing for her with one hand and trying to get something out of the pocket of his camo pants with the other. Before he can touch her, Harry tackles him and they go reeling into the closet, falling and pulling down more dresses and skirts and pants and tops, so at first Gwendy can see nothing but a pile of clothes that appears to be breathing. Then a hand emerges, a dirty hand with blue webbing tattooed across the back. It paws around aimlessly at first and finds the button box. Gwendy tries to scream, but nothing comes out. Her throat is locked tight. The box comes down corner first, once, then twice, then three times. The first time it connects with Harry's head, the sound is muffled by clothes. The second time it's louder. The third time the hit produces a sickening crack, like a breaking branch, and the corner of the box is coated with blood and hair. The clothes heave and slide. Frankie emerges, still holding the button box in one tattooed hand. He's grinning. Behind him, she can see Harry. His eyes are closed. His mouth hangs open.
"Don't know what this is, pretty girl, but it hits real good."
She darts past him. He doesn't try to stop her. She goes on her knees beside Harry and lifts his head with one hand. She cups the other palm in front of his nose and mouth, but she already knows. The box used to be light, but for a while tonight it was heavy because it wanted to be heavy. Frankie Stone has used it to crush the top of Harry Streeter's skull. There is no breath on her palm. "You killed him. You filthy son of a bitch. You killed him."
"Yeah, well, maybe, whatever."
He seems uninterested in the dead boy. His eyes are busily crawling over Gwendy's body, and she understands he's crazy. A box that can destroy the world is in the hands of a crazy person who thinks he's a Green Beret or a Navy SEAL or something like that.
"What is this thing? Besides where you store your silver dollars, that is. How much are they worth, Gwenny? And what do these buttons do?"
He touches the green one, then the violet one. And as his grimy thumb moves toward the black one, Gwendy does the only thing she can think of, only she doesn't think, she just acts. Her bra closes in front, and now she opens it. "Do you want to play with those buttons? Or with mine?" Frankie grins, exposing teeth that would make even a hardened dentist wince and turn away. He reaches into his pocket again and pulls out a knife. It reminds her of Lenny's, except there's no Semper Fi engraved on it.
"Get over on the bed, prom queen. Don't bother taking off your panties. I want to cut them off you. If you lay real still, maybe I won't cut what's underneath."
"Did he send you?" Gwendy asks. She's sitting on her bottom now with her feet on the floor and her legs drawn up to hide her breasts. With luck, one look at them is all this sick bastard is going to get.
"Did Mr. Ferris send you to take the box? Did he want you to have it?"
Although the evidence seems to point to this, it's hard to believe. He's frowning.
"Mr. Who?"
"Ferris. Black suit. Little black hat that goes wherever it wants to."
"I don't know any Mr. F-"
And that's when she lashes out, once again not thinking. Although later it will occur to her that the box might have been thinking for her. His eyes widen, and the hand holding the knife pistons forward, driving through her foot and coming out the other side in a bouquet of blood. She shrieks as her heel slams into Frankie's chest, driving him back into the closet. She snatches up the button box, and at the same time she pushes the red button, she screams,
"Rot in hell!"
30. Gwendy Peterson graduates from Brown summa cum laude in June of 1984. There has been no running track for her since her senior spring in high school. The knife wound in her foot got infected while she was in the hospital, and although it cleared eventually, she lost a piece of it. She still walks with a limp, although now it is barely discernible. She goes out to dinner with her parents after the ceremony, and they have a fine time. Mr. and Mrs. Peterson even break their long abstinence with a bottle of champagne to toast their daughter, who is bound for Columbia Grad School or, perhaps, the Iowa Writers' Workshop. She thinks she might have a novel in her, maybe more than one. "And is there a man in your life?" Mrs. Peterson asks. Her color is high, and her eyes are bright from the unaccustomed alcohol. Gwendy shakes her head, smiling. "No man, currently. Nor, she thinks, will there be in the future. She already has a significant other. It's a box with 8 buttons on top and 2 levers on the side. She still eats the occasional chocolate, but she hasn't taken one of the silver dollars in years. The ones she did have are gone, parceled out 1 or 2 at a time for books, rent, oh God, the luxury of a single apartment, and an upgrade from the Fiesta to a Subaru Outback, which outraged her mother, but she got over it eventually.
"Well," says Mr. Peterson, "there's time for that."
"Yes," Gwendy smiles. "I have plenty of time." 31.
She's going to spend the summer in Castle Rock, so when her parents have gone back to their hotel, she packs up the last of her things, stowing the button box at the very bottom of her trunk. During her time at Brown, she kept the awful thing in a safe deposit box in the Bank of Rhode Island, something she wishes she had thought of doing sooner, but she was just a kid when she got it. A kid? God damn it. And what do kids know? Kids stow valuables in cavities under trees, or behind loose stones in cellars prone to flooding, or in closets. In closets, for Christ's sake. Once she gets to Columbia, or Iowa City if the writer's workshop accepts her, it will go into another safety deposit box, and as far as she's concerned, it can stay there forever. She decides to have a slice of coffee cake and a glass of milk before going to bed. She gets as far as the living room, and there she stops cold. Sitting on the desk, where she has attended to her studies for the last 2 years, next to a framed picture of Harry Streeter, is a small, neat, black hat. She has no doubt that it's the one she last saw on the day she and Harry were flying that kite on the baseball field. Such a happy day that was. Maybe the last happy one.
"Come on out here, Gwendy," Mr. Ferris calls from the kitchen. "Set a spell, as they say down south."
She walks into the kitchen, feeling like a visitor in her own body. Mr. Ferris, in his neat black suit and not looking a day older, sits at the kitchen table. He has a piece of coffee cake and a glass of milk. Her own cake and milk are waiting for her. He looks her up and down, but, as on that day 10 years ago when she first met him at the top of the suicide stairs, without salacious intent.
"What a fine young woman you've grown into, Gwendy Peterson."
She doesn't thank him for the compliment, but she sits down. To her, this conversation seems long overdue. Probably not to him. She has an idea that Mr. Ferris has his own schedule and he always stays on it. What she says is, "I locked up when I went out. I always lock up, and the door was still locked when I came back. I always make sure. That's a habit I got into on the day Harry died. Do you know about Harry? If you knew I wanted coffee cake and milk, I suppose you do."
"Of course. I know a great deal about you, Gwendy. As for the locks," he waves it aside as if to say pish-tush.
"Have you come for the box?" She hears both eagerness and reluctance in her voice, a strange combination but one she knows quite well. He ignores this, at least for the time being.
"As I said, I know a great deal about you. But I don't know exactly what happened on the day the Stone Kid came to your house. There's always a crisis with the button box, a moment of truth, one could say. And when it comes, my ability to see is lost. Tell me what happened."
"Do I have to?" He raises a hand and turns it over as if to say, "Up to you." "I've never told anyone."
"And never will, would be my guess. This is your one chance."
"I said I hoped he'd rot in hell, and I pushed the red button at the same time. I didn't mean it literally, but he'd just killed the boy I loved. He'd just stuck a knife right through my fucking foot, and it was what came out. I never thought he'd actually..." "Only he did." She falls silent, remembering how Frankie's face began to turn black, how his eyes first went cloudy and then lolled forward in their sockets, how his mouth drooped, the lower lip unrolling like a shade with a broken spring. His scream, surprise, agony, both, she doesn't know, that blew the teeth right out of his putrefying gums in a shower of yellow and black. His jaw tearing loose, his chin falling all the way down to his chest, the ghastly ripping sound his neck made when it tore open, the river of pus from his cheeks as they pulled apart like rotting sailcloth. "I don't know if he rotted in hell, but he certainly rotted," Gwendy says. She pushes away the coffee cake. She no longer wants it.
"What was your story?" he asks. "Tell me that. You must have thought remarkably fast."
"I don't know if I did or not. I've always wondered if the box did the thinking for me." She waits for him to respond. He doesn't, so she goes on. "I closed my eyes and pushed the red button again while I imagined Frankie gone. I concentrated on that as hard as I could, and when I opened my eyes, only Harry was in the closet. She shakes her head wonderingly. It worked.
Of course it worked, Mr. Ferris said. The red button is very versatile, shall we say.
Yes, let's say that. But in 10 years, you only pushed it a few times, showing you to be a person of strong will and stronger restraint. I salute you for that.
And he actually does, with his glass of milk.
Even once was too much, she says. I caused Jonestown.
You give yourself far too much credit, he says sharply. Jim Jones caused Jonestown. The so-called Reverend was as crazy as a rat in a rain barrel, paranoid, mother-fixated, and full of deadly conceit. As for your friend Olive, I know you've always felt you were somehow responsible for her suicide, but I assure you that's not the case. Olive had issues. Your word for it.
She stares at him amazed. How much of her life has he been peering into? Like a pervert. Frankie Stone, for instance, going through her underwear drawer.
One of those issues was her stepfather. How shall I put it? He fiddled with her.
Are you serious?
As a heart attack. And you know the truth about young Mr. Stone.
She does. The police tied him to at least 4 other rapes and 2 attempted rapes in the Castle Rock area. Perhaps also to the rape murder of a girl in Cleves Mills. The cops are less sure about that one, but Gwendy's positive it was him.
Stone was fixated on you for years, Gwendy, and he got exactly what he deserved. Now, he was responsible for the death of your Mr. Streeter, not the button box.
She barely hears this. She's remembering what she usually banishes from her mind, except in dreams when she can't. I told the police that Harry kept Frankie from raping me, that they fought, that Harry was killed and Frankie ran away. I suppose they're still looking for him. I hid the box in my dresser along with the coins. I thought about dipping one of my high-heel shoes in Harry's blood to explain the bludgeoning, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. In the end, it didn't matter. They just assumed Frankie took the murder weapon with him.
Mr. Ferris nods. It's far from a case of all's well that ends well, but as well as can be, at least.
Gwendy's face breaks into a bitter smile that makes her look years older than 22. You make it all sound so good, as if I were Saint Gwendy. I know better. If you hadn't given me that goddamn box, things would have been different.
If Lee Harvey Oswald hadn't gotten a job at the Texas Book Depository, Kennedy would have finished out his term, Mr. Ferris says. You can if things until you go crazy, my girl.
Spin it any way you want, Mr. Ferris, but if you'd never given me that box, Harry would still be alive. And Olive. He considers.
Harry, yes, maybe. Maybe. Olive, however, was doomed. You bear no responsibility for her, believe me. He smiles. And good news! You're going to be accepted at Iowa. Your first novel.
He grins.
Well, let that be a surprise. I'll only say that you'll want to wear your prettiest dress when you pick up your award.
What award? She is both surprised and a little disgusted at how greedy she is for the news. He once more waves his hand in that pish-tush gesture.
I've said enough. Any more and I'll bend the course of your future, so please don't tempt me. I might give in if you did, because I like you, Gwendy. Your proprietorship of the box has been exceptional. I know the burden it's been, sometimes like carrying an invisible pack sack full of rocks on your back. But you will never know the good you've done, the disasters you've averted. When used with bad intent, which you never did, by the way, even your experiment with Guyana was done out of simple curiosity, the box has an unimaginable capacity for evil. When left alone, it can be a strong force for good.
My parents were on their way to alcoholism, Gwendy says. Looking back on it, I'm almost sure of that. But they stopped drinking.
Yes, and who knows how many worse things the box might have prevented during your proprietorship. Not even I know. Mass slaughters? A dirty suitcase bomb planted in Grand Central Station? The assassination of a leader that might have sparked World War III? It hasn't stopped everything. We both read the newspapers. But I'll tell you one thing, Gwendy. He leans forward, pinning her with his eyes. It has stopped a lot. a lot. And now? Now, I'll thank you to give me the button box. Your work is done. At least that part of your work is done. You still have many things to tell the world, and the world will listen. You will entertain people, which is the greatest gift a man or woman can have. You'll make them laugh, cry, gasp, think. By the time you're 35, you'll have a computer to write on instead of a typewriter, but both are button boxes of a kind, wouldn't you say? You will live a long life. How long? Again, she feels that mixture of greed and reluctance. That I will not tell you, only that you will die surrounded by friends. In a pretty nightgown, with blue flowers on the hem. There will be sun shining in your window, and before you pass, you will look out and see a squadron of birds flying south. A final image of the world's beauty. There will be a little pain. Not much. He takes a bite of his coffee cake, then stands. Very tasty, but I'm already late for my next appointment. The box, please. Who gets it next? Or can you not tell me that either? Not sure. I have my eye on a boy in a little town called Pescadero, about an hour south of San Francisco. You will never meet him. I hope, Gwendy, he's as good a custodian as you have been. He bends toward her and kisses her on the cheek. The touch of his lips makes her happy, the way the little chocolate animals always did. It's at the bottom of my trunk, Gwendy says, in the bedroom. The trunk's not locked, although I guess that wouldn't cause any problems, even if it was. She laughs, then sobers. I don't want to touch it again or even look at it, because if I did... He's smiling, but his eyes are grave. If you did, you might want to keep it. Yes. Sit here, then. Finish your coffee cake. It really is good. He leaves her. 32. Gwendy sits. She eats her coffee cake in small, slow bites, washing each one down with a tiny sip of milk. She hears the squeak her trunk lid makes when it goes up. She hears the squeak when the lid is lowered again. She hears the snap-snap of the latches being considerately closed. She hears his footsteps approach the door to the hall and pause there. Will he say goodbye? He does not. The door opens and softly closes. Mr. Richard Ferris, first encountered on a bench at the top of Castleview's suicide stairs, has left her life. Gwendy sits for another minute, finishing the last bite of her cake, and thinking of a book she wants to write. A sprawling saga about a small town in Maine, one very much like her own. There will be love and horror. She isn't ready yet, but she thinks the time will come quite soon, 2 years, five at most. Then she will sit down at her typewriter, her button box, and start tapping away. At last she gets up and walks into the living room. There's a spring in her step. Already she feels lighter. The small black hat is no longer on her desk, but he's left her something anyway. An 1891 Morgan silver dollar. She picks it up, turning it this way and that, so its uncirculated surface can catch the light. Then she laughs and puts it in her pocket.
3. The Music Room.
The Enderbys were in their music room. So they called it, although it was really just the spare bedroom. Once they had thought it would be a little James or Jill Enderby's nursery. But after 10 years of trying, it seemed increasingly unlikely that a baby deer would arrive out of nowhere and into the here. They had made their peace with childlessness. At least they had work, which was a blessing in a year when men were still standing in bread lines. There were fallow periods, it was true, but when the job was on, they could afford to think of nothing else, and they both liked it that way. Mr. Enderby was reading the New York Journal American, a new daily not even halfway through its first year of publication. It was a sort of tabloid, and sort of not. He usually began with the comics, but when they were on the job, he turned to the city news first, scanning through the stories quickly, especially the police blotter. Mrs. Enderby sat at the piano, which had been a wedding gift from her parents. Occasionally she stroked a key but did not press any. Tonight the only music in the music room was the symphony of nighttime traffic on Third Avenue, which came in through the open window. Third Avenue, third floor. A good apartment in a sturdy brownstone. They rarely heard their neighbors above and below, and their neighbors rarely heard them, which was all to the good. From the closet behind them came a single thump, then another. Mrs. Enderby spread her hands as if to play, but when the thump ceased, she put her hands in her lap.
"Still not a peep about our pal George Timmons," Mr. Enderby said, rattling the paper.
"Perhaps you should check the Albany Herald," she said. "I believe the newsstand on Lexington and 60th carries it."
"No need," he said, turning to the funnies at last. "The Journal American is good enough for me. If Mr. Timmons has been reported missing in Albany, let those interested search for him there."
"That's fine, dear," said Mrs. Enderby. "I trust you." There was really no reason not to. To date, the work had gone swimmingly. Mr. Timmons was their sixth guest in the specially reinforced closet.
Mr. Enderby chuckled. "The Cats and Jammer kids are at it again. This time, they've caught their captain fishing illegally, shooting a net from a cannon, in fact. Quite amusing. Shall I read it to you?"
Before Mrs. Enderby could answer, another thump came from the closet, and faint sounds that might have been shouts. It was difficult to tell, unless one put one's ear right up against the wood, and she had no intention of doing that. The piano bench was as close to Mr. Timmons as she intended to get, until it was time to dispose of him.
"I wish he'd stop."
"He will, dear, soon enough."
Another thump, as if to refute this.
"That's what you said yesterday."
"It seems I was premature," said Mr. Enderby, and then, "Oh, gosh, Dick Tracy is once more on the hunt for Pruneface."
"Pruneface gives me the willies," she said without turning. "I wish Detective Tracy would put him away for good."
"That will never happen, dear. People claim to root for the hero, but it's the villains they remember."
Mrs. Enderby made no reply. She was waiting for the next thump. When it came, if it came, she would wait for the one after that. The waiting was the worst part. The poor man was hungry and thirsty, of course. They had ceased feeding and watering him 3 days ago, after he had signed the last check, the one that emptied his account. They had emptied his wallet at once of almost $200. In a depression as deep as this one, $200 was a jackpot, and his watch might add as much as 20 more to their earnings, although she admitted to herself that might be a trifle optimistic. Mr. Timmons' checking account at Albany National had been the real mother lode. $800. Once he was hungry enough, he had been happy to sign several checks made out to cash with the notation "business expenses" written in the proper spot on each one. Somewhere, a wife and kiddies might be depending on that money when Father didn't come home from his trip to New York, but Mrs. Enderby did not allow herself to dwell on that. She preferred to imagine Mrs. Timmons having a rich mama and papa in Albany's mansion district, a generous couple right out of a Dickens novel. They would take her in and care for her and her children, little boys who might be endearing scamps like Hans and Fritz, the Katzenjammer kids.
"Sluggo's broke a neighbor's window and is blaming it on Nancy," Mr. Enderby said with a chuckle. "I swear he makes the Katzenjammers look like angels."
"That awful hat he wears," Mrs. Enderby said.
Another thump from the closet, and a very hard one from a man who had been on the verge of starvation. But Mr. Timmons had been a big one. Even after a generous dose of chloral hydrate in his glass of dinner wine, he had nearly overpowered Mr. Enderby. Mrs. Enderby had had to help. She sat on Mr. Timmons's chest until he quieted. Unladylike, but necessary. That night the window on Third Avenue had been shut, as it always was when Mr. Enderby brought home a guest for dinner. He met them in bars. Very gregarious was Mr. Enderby, and very good at singling out businessmen who were alone in the city, fellows who were also gregarious and enjoyed making new friends, especially new friends who might become new clients of one business or another. Mr. Enderby judged them by their suits,
and he always had an eye for a gold watch chain.
"Bad news," Mr. Enderby said, a frown creasing his brow. She stiffened at the piano bench and turned to face him.
"What is it?"
"Ming the Merciless has imprisoned Flash Gordon and Dale Arden in the radium mines of Mongo. There are these creatures. They look sort of like alligators."
Now from the closet came a faint wailing cry. Within its soundproofed confines, it must have been a shriek, almost loud enough to rupture the poor man's vocal cords. How could Mr. Timmons still be strong enough to voice such a howl? He had already lasted a day longer than any of the previous five, and his somehow gruesome vitality had begun to prey on her nerves. She had been hoping that tonight would see the end of him. The rug in which he was to be wrapped was waiting in their bedroom, and the panel truck with Enderby Enterprises painted on the side was parked just around the corner, fully gassed and ready for another trip to the Pine Barrens of New Jersey. When they were first married, there had actually been an Enderby Enterprises. The Depression, what the Journal American had taken to calling the Great Depression, had put an end to that 2 years ago. Now they had this new work. "Dale is afraid," continued Mr. Enderby, "and Flash is trying to buck her up. He says Dr. Zarkov will..." Now came a fusillade of thumps, 10, maybe a dozen, and accompanied by more of those shrieks, muffled but still rather chilling. She could imagine blood beading Mr. Timmons's lips and dripping from his split knuckles. She could imagine how his neck would have grown scrawny, and how his formerly plump face would have stretched long as his body gobbled the fat and musculature there in order to stay alive. But no, a body couldn't cannibalize itself to stay alive, could it? The idea was as unscientific as phrenology. And how thirsty he must be by now.
"It is so annoying," she burst out. "I hate it that he just goes on and on and on. Why did you have to bring home such a strong man, dear?"
"Because he was also a well-to-do man," Mr. Enderby said mildly. "I could see that when he opened his wallet to pay for our second round of drinks. What he's contributed will keep us for 3 months, 5 if we stretch it."
Thump and thump and thump. Mrs. Enderby put her fingers to the delicate hollows of her temples and began to rub. Mr. Enderby looked at her sympathetically.
"I can put a stop to it if you like. He won't be able to struggle much in his current state. Certainly not after having expended so much energy. A quick slash with your sharpest butcher knife. Of course, if I do the deed, you will have to do the cleanup. It's only fair."
Mrs. Enderby looked at him shocked. "We may be thieves, but we are not murderers."
"That's not what people would say if we were caught." He spoke apologetically, but firmly enough, just the same.
She clasped her hands in the lap of her red dress tightly enough to whiten the knuckles, and looked straight into his eyes. "If we were called into the dock, I would hold my head up and tell the judge and the jury that we were victims of circumstance."
"And I'm sure you would be very convincing, dear."
Another thump from behind the closet door, and another cry. Gruesome. This was the word for his vitality, the exact one. Gruesome. "But we are not murderers. Our guests simply lack sustenance, as do so many in these terrible times. We don't kill them. They simply fade away." Another shriek came from the man Mr. Enderby had brought home from McSorley's over a week ago. It might have been words. It might have been, "For the love of God."
"It won't be long now," Mr. Enderby said. "If not tonight, then tomorrow. And we won't have to go back to work for quite a while. And yet..."
She looked at him, in that same steady way, hands clasped. "And yet..."
"Part of you enjoys it, I think. Not this part, but the actual moment when we take them, as a hunter takes an animal in the woods."
She considered this. "Perhaps I do. And I certainly enjoy seeing what they have in their wallets. It reminds me of the treasure hunts Papa used to put on for me and my brother when we were children. But afterward..." She sighed. "I was never good at waiting."
More thumps. Mr. Enderby turned to the business section. "He came from Albany, and people who come from there get what they deserve. Play something, dear. That will cheer you up."
So she got her sheet music out of the piano bench and played I'll Never Be the Same. Then she played I'm in a Dancing Mood and The Way You Look Tonight. Mr. Enderby applauded and called for an encore on that one, and when the last notes died away, the thumps and cries from the soundproofed and specially reinforced closet had ceased.
Music, Mr. Enderby proclaimed. It hath powers to soothe the savage beast.
That made them laugh together, comfortably, the way people do when they have been married for many years and have come to know each other's minds.
Gwendy's Button Box was written by Stephen King and Richard Chisnall. The Music Room was written by Stephen King. The reader was Maggie Stiff. The recording engineer was Nicholas Baxter, Igloo Music Studios in Burbank, California. Editing and post-production by Steven Strassman. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Tiffany Ferrari. Gwendy's Button Box and The Music Room were produced and directed by Christina Zarafanidis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also by Stephen King, The Dead Zone, read by James Franco, Mr. Mercedes, read by Will Patton, and Revival, read by David Morse. A Conversation with Stephen King and Richard Chismar.
Hi, this is author Richard Chismar, and I'm here with my friend and co-author Stephen King to talk about our new novella, Gwendy's Button Box.
Hi, Richard. I'm happy to have the opportunity to catch up with you and talk about this collaboration. With Gwendy's Button Box, I had a story that I couldn't finish. And Rich and I have known each other for a long time. We're real email pals. I sent him the story, and I said, if you can finish this, it's a collaboration, and I'll be damned if he didn't do it.
And for me, it was kind of the opportunity of a lifetime. You know, we do email and text a lot, and we usually talk in sports or books. And this time we started talking writing, and Steve mentioned that he had a story he couldn't finish. And I just said, hey, if you ever want to send it my way, feel free. The next evening it showed up with a note attached saying, do whatever you want with it. And I was struck with a couple moments of sheer terror. So I pulled out my laptop and started writing. And for me, the cool thing was, is within a matter of minutes, the nerves were gone. And I was lost in the story, and I was in Castle Rock.
Yeah, as far as the collaboration, I knew it would work because I'd read Rich's stories over the years. He's got a wonderful, thick collection called The Long December. And at the time that I sent him Gwendy's Button Box, I just read the title story in that collection, and I thought, you know, his style and my style are really not that different. We've got a kind of interest in just telling a story, engaging the reader, and then the questions maybe at the end of the story follow that as kind of an echo. So I thought we would work together really well, and I also knew from collaborating with my son Owen and my son Joe, Peter Straub, Stuart Onan, that during the rewriting process, it's like mixing cake batter in a way, and the styles get blended, and you end up with a third style. And for me, that's the real attraction of collaborating, is to see what that third voice sounds like. It's a little bit like when you hear a record and voices harmonize and they create another voice. And I knew from Rich's work that that would work, and it did.
Honestly, it was just a lot of fun. I didn't feel any restrictions. I didn't feel like I had any specific rules to follow. For me, the most important thing was I just really wanted to do the town justice. Castle Rock is mentioned in the very first sentence of the story. I was very aware the entire time, even after the nerves disappeared, that I was treading on sacred ground here. You know, Castle Rock is a lot like the small town I grew up in. I think an awful lot of listeners would probably say the same thing. I think that's one of Steve's gifts. He creates a place that is instantly identifiable to so many listeners.
And that's what I really want, is for people to think of Castle Rock as any town USA. I wanted to do Castle Rock because there's a part of the town that's called Castle View. I never explored that, and I knew it was somewhere up high where you could see all the surrounding countryside. And I had this idea about opening the story with this little girl named Gwendy Peterson, who every day runs up what's called the suicide stairs along the cliffside between Castle Rock and Castle View. She's in the process of trying to condition herself and lose a little weight before she goes into junior high school so that her elementary school nickname won't follow her. So Castle Rock seemed like the natural place to put it. I'm really excited to have Maggie Siff do the audio because I knew her work from Sons of Anarchy. I followed that show for 7 seasons, so I knew her voice really well. I thought she was a terrific choice for it. And there's even a little connection there because I had a chance to act in the show, and while we never had a scene together, you could almost say we've collaborated already.
I'm with Steve, actually. I really enjoyed Maggie's work with Sons of Anarchy. I'm watching her new show on Showtime, Billions, and I thought she was a wonderful choice to bring life to the story, especially the character of Wendy Peterson. I love the scene at the opening when she first receives the button box. I think listeners will sit there or drive down the highway with the sense of wonder every bit as much as Steve and I had when we were creating that.
I love that particular scene where Wendy has reached the top of these stairs and there's a man in a black suit with a little black hat on his head who says, "Come on over here, girl. You and me, we have to palaver." And Wendy is a girl who is like 12 years old, and this is a grown man sitting on a park bench. Kind of, well, there's people nearby, but there's nobody right there. And I love that tension that that creates immediately in the reader's mind. What does this grown man want to do with this girl? They don't know each other. They're strangers. So exactly what's going on here? There's also a scene near the middle of the story where Gwendy meets a coin dealer at a coin show. And she's threatened after she makes a deal, but the coin dealer kind of defends her. And that's a high contrast, antagonist-protagonist scene. So I love that. I like the way that the story turned out. And when that happens, you can think of a lot of different places where you can say, yeah, that actually works. The opposite is also true. You can think of some places where you say, nah, this might creak a little bit, or this could have been done better. But for the most part, the story seems to stand up, and that's all any writer can ask for.
I just think it's a darn good story. I think it's a lot of fun. I think it's scary at times. I think it covers a lot of emotional ground. I think Gwendy's a pretty terrific character. I think an awful lot of listeners will relate to her and enjoy going on her journey. Steve, it's been great catching up with you today, and it was a pleasure working on this story with you, and I appreciate going along for the ride.
You too, Rich. Always a pleasure.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.